Janet. Today's focus is really a very appropriate follow-up to the President's Banquet and the Jonathan Mann lecture last night, for those of you fortunate enough to hear Dr. K.G. Fukuda speak. We have two speakers to talk about global refugee issues. It's my pleasure to introduce the first speaker, Dr. Marty Cetron, who I think most of us know. He's the director of the Global Migration and Quarantine Centers for the CDC. And Marty's been doing his job about as long as I have. We were actually in the same EIS class a very long time ago, back in 1992. And I've been amazed at how the quarantine service has really grown under his watch. I think when he took the job, it was an office within the National Center for Infectious Diseases, and now it's its own division. And it's I think there were about 8 quarantine stations. There's probably over 20 now throughout the country. But really, their primary focus has been in ensuring that medical screening and disease prevention programs for over 80,000 refugees and 1 million immigrants coming into the U.S. annually. I was inspired by Dr. Fukuda's talk last night, and I was doing a little bit of internet searching this morning on Marty, and I found this quote from him that I just thought I'd read before I have him take the podium. "We often go into the field with great enthusiasm for what we bring to the table, the services or skills we have to offer, and are sometimes chagrined by the enormous treasures offered up by our partners in the communities. We can learn so much from empowering each other to solve problems together. That cross-cultural collective effort is what makes international public health so rewarding." As somebody who does communicable disease in New York City, we occasionally have had to interact with Marty over the 25 years I've been there. And what I've also been impressed with is no matter what time of day I call or email him, he is always immediately available, and I can trust him to give me honest, open, and frank advice about the issues that we're facing. So I want to welcome him for coming today to provide his perspectives on health security in the context of the global refugee crisis. So join me in welcoming Dr. Cetron.
Thank you so much, Marcy. That was very kind, and it's really my honor to be here and also to pick up on the thread, the inspirational thread that KG left about what he sees as the two great challenges ahead, one in climate and the other in displacement. So what I'm going to do, Chris and I have spoken a little bit to coordinate. I'm going to give you, I hope, the big picture internationally, then a focus on what CDC is doing sort of globally on the sort of pre-arrival side. And I'll leave it to Chris and her sort of capable hands to talk a little bit more about the domestic side of refugee resettlement, which I know touches many of you in this room. But I want to take you both on a visual journey, and I hope the colors and the slides aren't too washed out, just to give you a feel for the context. Wars and political unrest in Syria, Somalia, they have forced people to leave their countries. We have ethnic minorities in Burma that are actively fleeing persecution and poverty, and the significant continued unrest on the African continent, particularly in the Congo, forcing people into refuge in neighboring countries. And with so many countries under siege, we are now experiencing the largest refugee crisis since World War II. But I did want to say, and here's two graphics that I think kind of put this in a little bit of perspective. The number of people that are displaced by war is shown in the darker graph, and you can see this is a couple of years back. It reaches about almost 60 million. We're about 65 million now. But as a percent of the world's population, the number of migration has just been a fact of human history. And roughly, it's fairly stable at around 3% of the world's population are international migrants. That is those people the UN defines as living outside their country of birth for more than a year. Now, not all international migrants are refugees. So let me break out a little bit of the data for you. This is a UNHCR slide. And you can see that of the 65 million forcibly displaced persons, Only 21.3 million meet the formal UNHCR definition of a refugee, which means you have to have crossed an international boundary, be outside your country of birth, and have a legitimate fear of persecution or threat upon returning home, so unable to return home. So of the 65 million forcibly displaced, the majority are displaced within internally displaced persons, or IDPs, and displaced by war and conflict and violence within their international boundaries. And you can see there's an additional subset of 10 million people who are functionally stateless. And the refugees that actually are eligible and are actively resettled as a permanent solution to this forced displacement is really a quite small number in comparison to the total. So 107,000 of this total 65 million benefit from resettlement as a durable solution. If you look at where the displaced populations are being hosted, one of the things, particularly pay attention to the line graph on the far left of your slide, the vast majority after internal displacement are being hosted in neighboring countries. And so while it does seem from the media that there's this onslaught of refugees moving into Europe and into the West, the truth of the matter is that the major burden of refugee displacement is in the immediate region on neighboring host countries. Let's just look at Syria, for example, a country devastated by now many years of brutal civil war. 7.6 million are internally displaced, 4.8 million are displaced to neighboring countries, and only 1.5 million of those have landed in Europe over the last 2.5 years. So again, some of the specific statistics are that the refugee crisis really impacts locally much more dramatically than it impacts in distant locations, although you don't always get that same perspective by following the media. And this is a tremendous strain on resources of neighboring countries, but one that often they do willingly and with welcome and open arms. You can see that in some cases the entire demography of these neighboring countries can be affected and skewed by the large numbers of people that flee for their lives by moving right across a border. So let me just show you a couple of images from the sort of devastation of the protracted war in Syria. It's notable that almost half of the displaced people from this war are children. And of course, as KG mentioned yesterday about the power of fear, I would say that in our experience in public health, we see three things that go hand in hand. Epidemics of disease are followed by epidemics of fear, as KG pointed out, and also by epidemics of stigma. And there's a tremendous amount of stigma that gets associated and attributed and confounded into these public health crises. This is a very unsavory cartoon that highlights trying to distinguish the difference in terms of types of migrants, from the forcibly displaced refugee, from the economic migrant that is seeking a better opportunity. And the idea that maybe not all the refugees are really as desperate as you think, and most of them just want to come and take our jobs and things like that. A lot of misinformation and gets wrapped up into the epidemic of fear and creates a tremendous amount of stigma. It's not all uniformly bad, and as KG mentioned, the idea of appealing to our common humanity is also one of the upward signs of some of these crises, that the resilience in a community, the acts of loving kindness that you see in receiving populations are there, as well as the fear and stigma. And figuring out how to navigate this tension has become a major a political issue, as many are aware. So these are some scenes from the European migration. We're not immune to that here. There's unfortunately a divisive false narrative and a divisive rhetoric that goes on you know, it's an either or, a false dichotomy that it's either our security or a humanitarian effort. And I think we need to encourage one another to dispel this false myth. It's not an either or. There's a both and. Health security and health as a human right can live in coexistence. But particularly around last year's election, we saw tremendous polarization in discussion and perception of the refugee. And there's a phenomenon that, you know, I'm referring to as refugee amnesia. But in fact, you know, displaced populations and refugee crises are not new in human history, and they're certainly not new in recent 20th century history, as these slides depict here. These are European refugees leaving during World War II, and here are some Hungarian refugees from 56, and certainly more recently in the post-Vietnam era, the large amount of refugee migration out of Southeast Asia. But somehow we forget and believe that this is a urgent, desperate crisis that is only affecting us in our current time. But what is different is the landscape. There's a real change in the migration narrative, one from, you know, the tension between aspiration and desperation. There's an increasing exploitation of the refugee community and criminal networks that are building up around the movement process, whether it's exploitation of children and women during movement, or criminal and other types of activities. So these are all becoming interwoven in the story, and they only serve to contribute to the escalation of the fear and the stigma. There's a tremendous amount of xenophobia that emerges in this setting, and an increase in much more irregular migration and conditions of vulnerability. Coincidental with this is also a decline in public confidence about the government's ability to manage these large migration flows. And so fear and distrust and a lot of nationalistic rhetoric emerges in this setting. And then you blend that with the impact of a global escalation of extremism, and you have really a volatile situation, which is, adds a lot of fuel to the fire of how we manage this forced displacement. Many will have a hard time forgetting the image of Alan Kurdi washed up on the shores after a dangerous migration journey across the Mediterranean. But sadly, these forced displaced populations now are experiencing a tremendous amount of mortality simply associated with the hazards of the journey. More than 40,000 deaths have occurred in the Mediterranean alone since 2000. And you can imagine the desperation of a population that has to leave a situation like a war in Syria with the use of chemical weapons by its government, only to face a journey across the Mediterranean in dinghies and the hazards of the trip. So these are pretty staggering. And if you look at estimates from IOM of those that have died just during the migration journey, they're pretty impressive. But clearly what stands out is this 3,700-plus deaths associated with crossing the Mediterranean. And as I mentioned, resettlement can be a very vital protection tool, but less than 1% of refugees are ultimately afforded third country resettlement. And the number of host countries willing to take refugees for resettlement as a solution is vanishingly small. This is the family of Alan Kurdi being resettled to Canada in 2016 with open arms and welcoming. And can imagine the emotional roller coaster that it takes to go through that. But resettlement in welcoming communities is often the single best thing that can happen to a family in crisis. Now, this is also happening in a time where there are rising, emerging threats that we've all experienced and talk about. And so here's just an arc of the recent kinds of emerging threats. And concurrent with that, we're at this unprecedented time of migration and human mobility. And what I'd like to argue and show you with the rest of the presentation is how to intersect both the concern and threats about emerging infections with the ability to address global health security, and that it's really unattainable without addressing individual health security, and that means including the health of the migrants and the mobile populations, and that it can be a win-win situation. It's not a zero-sum game. Either we let them in and we are at risk of these threats, or we don't let them in at all and we're somehow protected. So let me talk about this journey to well-being from the U.S. perspective. Just to quickly mention, our program's regulatory authority dates back a long while with regard to the ability to address immigration and refugee health. These are three particular statutory acts, which the oldest of which is the Federal Quarantine Regulations from 1798. And each of these play into the legal authority and mandate that we have. Probably the most important one is the Refugee Act of 1980 with regard to this population. And it allows us to intervene directly and prevent and control infectious diseases, even at the origin, to define the disease of public health significance, to meet arriving populations of refugees at ports of entry, and to provide a comprehensive notification program of health conditions to you all in state and local health departments and to the clinical providers seeing this community. In terms of the past year, this is just sort of an estimate of the annual arrivals for which we're responsible, and you can see the tip of the pyramid and probably the most vulnerable in the past year, about the 85,000 refugees that were admitted. And following that, the 1 million immigrant applicants for lawful permanent residence. And then there are other visa categories and so on. So the longer view of this over about a decade, you can see that we have had nadirs of 50,000, and certainly post 9/11 with enhanced security and what's now being referred to as extreme vetting, the numbers have gone low. But the floor of that is set in statute by the Act at about 50,000. We have had times where we've resettled over 100,000, and here's just a regional breakdown of that. Most notably, the blue, the African resettlement, and the very top, the Near East South Asia resettlement, is making up the bulk of that. But these 85,000 people departed from a wide variety of locations, and this somewhat difficult to read map, I'm sure, shows both the countries of origin as well as the countries of asylum, usually the neighboring countries, that are hosting the displaced population and where they're coming from in order to arrive in the U.S. This is a look at the top 10 countries by nationality for 2016. And so you can see Congolese made up our largest, followed in 2016 by Syrians, Burmese, Iraqis, and Somalis, and the sort of trailing five shown below. In terms of states hosting resettlement, the initial decision ultimately is sort of a federal allocation decision, but the migration and the receptivity that refugees will find in states will vary according to a lot of things, including services, availability of health support and other job opportunities, and where communities are found that are welcoming. You can see in red the three largest resettlement states, but I'm sure Chris will point out that this is absolute numbers, not per capita. So I'm told that Idaho is one of the largest receiving states per capita, adjusted for its population size. And Chris will tell you more about that. In order to execute this program, we have three large international platforms that have regional functionality in Kenya and Nairobi that covers all of Africa, and Bangkok covering Asia, and most recently the addition of staff in Amman, Jordan, to deal with the crisis in the Middle East. Here's some of the locations from which the refugees are departing and where they're hosted by nationality. So you can see the sort of predominant emphasis on East and South Africa in terms of the source. Now, last year, President Obama committed to scaling up the Middle Eastern resettlement program and with a target of 10,000 Syrians. And that number was actually exceeded with a lot of effort. A big surge took place in Jordan. And the Syrian health profile, together with us in the International Organization of Migration, was done in terms of rapid assessment of what the needs of these populations were. And by and large, compared to African refugee resettlements, the infectious disease burden was smaller, but the chronic disease burden was quite significant. I won't go into detail about this, but surging to deal with the increased numbers in a setting of very heightened security requirements and tremendous amount of vetting is not a fast process, and it can take on average about 2 years to move refugees from, once they're even handed over from UNHCR to the U.S. caseload, to actually get them into the United States. Here's some of the quick health conditions that were identified in the rapid needs assessment. As you can see, chronic diseases predominated. Now, the components of our overseas medical exam, and these apply not just to refugees, but all the immigrant screening is done, are shown here in this slide. And the most predominant one that is of interest to many in this room is the TB screening activities. I'll go into some detail. But we also have vaccine administration programs, mass drug administration for parasitic infections, and testing for a variety of STIs. In terms of the TB screening, the screening program has really evolved a significant amount in the last two decades. It used to be limited to smear-based detection, clearing a smear, focused only on adults. And we had a lot of cases of TB that occurred within 6 months of arrival. That program, was the ability to revisit that program and address it was highlighted by something everyone in this room knows, which is the disproportionate burden of tuberculosis and drug-resistant tuberculosis in foreign-born populations, as shown in this slide. And you can see the incidence is, more than tenfold higher among foreign-born. And this happens because we're crossing a huge prevalence gap, which is shown here in the map, between where the high-burden TB countries on the African subcontinent as well as in Southeast Asia, compared to the relatively low incidence countries in the West. And we're crossing this gap, and so we need to be vigorous about both the screening and the health opportunities that are offered. Very early on, Sue Maloney and others in our shop were involved in doing some studies looking at how poor how poor smear sensitivity was in detecting cases. And so we moved over to a culture-based system and published the results of the impact of that in 2015. And I'll go through a little bit of that. So the precursor was looking at this high risk, the B1, smear, culture positive and smear negative cases really had very high rates of TB conversion shortly after arrival, and this needed to be addressed. When we looked at this algorithm, our old algorithm, we found that the sensitivity of picking up cases was only about 33%. And so we moved to this culture-based algorithm. We also dropped the screening age from 12 to 2. We brought in some LTBI testing, particularly in children. We focused on the higher burden areas, and we moved from smear detection to culture, and we also added a directly observed therapy program to cure. And these types of activities really enhanced our ability to detect TB. The strategy was implemented globally in 2013. We had a 5-year rollout where we targeted large volume and high burden countries. And in order to do this, an entire infrastructure for TB culture capacity and DOT needed to be developed, linked to panel physicians to TB control programs in countries of origin. We work with over 700 panel physicians around the globe to execute on this mission. The location is shown here on this map. And we have to regularly visit all of these sites in order to maintain quality assurance on all aspects, both the fraud protection, the clinical examination, the laboratory capacity, and the DOT programs are maintained vigorously. This is just an example of some of the trips of our quality assurance program team that made in the last year to visiting these sites and keeping the quality high. There's a lot of laboratory capacity building that spins off out of this. New laboratories were created in these countries shown here. Expansion of laboratories are shown in some of the others. And we have more laboratories that can do second line testing for drug susceptibility. So rather than wait for treatment failures to adjust regimens, we do DST up front and have targeted treatments from the beginning. The other benefit is by doing active surveillance in these populations, we get a much better incidence rate than what's being reported through WHO systems through passive surveillance through national governments. And mostly this table is meant to convey the fact that on average, a good program, we're finding about 3 times the burden of disease through active screening of this population than is usually reported through passive systems. We also have good data on drug susceptibility that we have because every case gets cultured up front. So as a result of these types of improvements, we've seen for the first time in more than half a century a decrease in the foreign-born incidence of foreign-born TB in the United States. And this decrease, which is shown in this graph, is really highlighted clearly in the figure from the paper I alluded to, which is the decline of cases is directly matched by the increased diagnosis and treatment to cure overseas. It's literally a mirror image. We've realized that we need to move beyond active disease, and there are some pilot programs looking at how to address LTBI, but keeping patients with LTBI out of the country, applicants, is really not reasonable or feasible, and so increasing detection of LTBI increases the burden on people in this room to do follow-up comprehensive prevention programs, and we still have a long way to go in order to increase the ability to prevent new cases from those latently infected. There's also a big component of outbreak response and detection that goes on in these populations. I'll show you a couple maps of major outbreaks that have gone on. This is 06 to 08. With the implementation of a vaccination program, a lot of these are vaccine-preventable diseases. Some are diseases which are continuous epidemic and endemic scourges like cholera. And here's another more recent map of the last 2.5 years of disease outbreaks affecting communities and populations that are hosting our refugees that we're directly involved in, and usually surveillance and control programs that we deploy to in order to try to reduce the burden of this effect prior to resettlement. More recently, we've had really large cholera outbreaks across the African continent and continued outbreaks of measles that result in introductions and further spread in unvaccinated communities in the U.S. So why should we vaccinate overseas? Well, refugees are incompletely immunized because of the collapse of their structures. Outbreaks occur during and after resettlement. It causes travel delays, significant morbidity and mortality, and school entry delays for children on arrival. So we try to get at least one dose in of most of the ACIP recommended vaccines when possible before resettlement. And some of the in some cases we have enough time to complete a series, but we always try to get at least a single dose in. These are some of the current diseases that are covered in the program, the vaccination programs. Here's the schedule. I won't go into that in detail, but you can see with exception of hepatitis B, in which we do surface antigen testing and only selectively vaccinate, we basically try to provide these complete services with pre-qualified WHO-approved vaccines, maintain cold chain surveillance for adverse events, just like a full Western program in many of these austere settings. Now, refugee vaccination is something we've attempted that's new because it's not required by law, unlike immigrants. It's a policy decision, and it requires funding. And so it's taken us a little while to get this off the ground. We have a three-tier system of countries, and it started in about 2013, but since then it's been scaling up pretty significantly, as you can see here. So currently we cover about 60% of the U.S.-bound refugees. The Tier 1 countries are shown here in terms of their completion, or the Tier 1, 2, and 3 countries. We're into Tier 2 countries, and we're moving with goals to move into Tier 3 countries. What you can also see from this, here's our Tier 1 pilot countries, is that coverage rates are exceedingly high, over 99%, 98% in most locations, which is, you know, it is a challenge, as those of you who work in this area know, to get coverage rates up. But we find that the opportunity of movement, as well as the circumstances, allows for much more compliance with vaccination programs in these settings. And often these coverage rates are higher than can be achieved with the same communities once they're in the U.S., either because of access issues or because of other types of service barriers in terms of getting the populations into the area. Here's the Tier 2 countries, and the coverage for these core vaccines is still very, very high. And here are the Tier 3 countries, which are not serviced by International Organization of Migration. Most of these are pending rollout. Now, we still have vaccine-preventable diseases in U.S.-bound refugees, but many of them are for diseases that are outside the core vaccines recommended, as you can see here. And we are looking at expanding the coverage of vaccines in order to address the epidemic-prone conditions, as you can see, like meningitis, for example. Now, cost comparison. I often get asked, well, isn't that a really expensive program to run? In general, vaccinating overseas is about 83% less costly for giving the same vaccines than doing it in the U.S., $46 per capita versus $272 for this comprehensive list. And if you were to even compare just completing the series, it's much cheaper, as shown here. Probably easier to see the overall program costs for completing ACIP recommended vaccine series, whether you compare it to a Medicaid RMA system, refugee medical assistance, or a private sector system. It's much more cost effective to begin this immunization program overseas, upstream. So the future direction is to get 100% of the countries to achieve at least 95% coverage and to have technical updates that expand the vaccine list and also good monitoring and evaluation, as well as good communication of the vaccination results and integrating it with U.S. Record systems. We also try to manage neglected tropical diseases in the refugees before arrival. This is just some examples of the huge burden that occurs. And we do this by a comprehensive Mass Drug Administration program that uses Coartem for malaria, Praziquantel for schistosomiasis, Albendazole for soil-transmitted helminths, and Ivermectin for strongyloidiasis. And these are the countries in the schedule and the place where those things are recommended. We have been able to treat over 65,000 refugees in 2016 with this type of Mass Drug Administration program. And some early work that was done together with folks in Minnesota, Bill Stauffer and others, really showed a dramatic decrease in the burden of soil-transmitted helminths and other infections in refugees by using this Mass Drug Administration program. Again, when you look at it from a cost, it's not only the right thing to do, it's the smart thing to do. This is a look at 27 or 28,000 people in the program, and what you can see is the overseas Mass Drug Administration program is a fraction of the total cost and has even greater impact than trying to accomplish this type of work. With the skyrocketing prices of orphan drugs, I'm thinking particularly of a variety of drugs which can be given for pennies overseas that sometimes cost hundreds or thousands of dollars to access in the U.S., this is really clearly the way to go. In Hennepin County, they've essentially seen a disappearance of malaria in the arriving refugee population since the program has been in place, and we've been using anti-malarials since 1998 as a result of some of the outbreaks that we've been involved in. We depend on you all for surveillance of emerging drug resistance, and when TMP sulfa was no longer working and we had cases popping up in the U.S., we switched our regimen to Coartem, and so that back and forth interaction between our programs and our interventions overseas and the impact and the effectiveness that you were seeing is really important. What we're trying to do to maintain high levels of information is to provide refugee health profiles on our website for different populations and be able to share with you some background on who they are, where they are, where they're from, what they've been exposed to, and what the types of interventions that they've received are, so that this work doesn't need to be repeated in the states and you can take the benefit of these upstream interventions. We're also writing what I call the Reverse Yellow Book, which is a series of health guidelines to help people know how to take care of the incoming population of both immigrants and refugees, but it's focused right now on the refugee health domestic guidelines that are being led with some clinicians, Bill Stauffer and others, taking the lead on putting these together. And so look for these on our website if you want to have training in how to manage these groups. We're trying to increase our notification to state and local health departments through a variety of means, outbreak notices, news updates, linkage and monthly calls with refugee health coordinators. So there are people in your programs who are kind of tapped in to what's going on. And recently we've been funding a number of cooperative agreements in states to strengthen disease surveillance after arrival in newly arrived immigrants and refugees. This is a photo from one of the programs here, which has morphed from a multi-state direct program into a Centers of Excellence program coordinated out of Minnesota and Colorado. I won't go into the details of that, but they are linking in multiple other states that were part of the earlier funding round. And they're creating multi-state refugee health surveillance systems, dashboards and databases to provide visualization and to maintain currency on what some of these programs look like. The guidelines activity is led out of the Minnesota Center of Excellence. We're pulling in consultations with experts in tropical diseases to be able to provide feedback and services, pediatric and adult, in these regards. We're also beefing up our EDN system, electronic disease notification system, and trying to enhance bidirectionality in the feedback so that the data are available. We're trying to link our refugee vaccination records with immunization registries in selected states and pilots so that people will know how many vaccines and what was given so that you don't have to repeat vaccination in this regard. Expanding the web services and expanding EDN users to the actual clinicians that are seeing the patients in your states. In addition, we've embarked in the last year and hope to begin rolling out a new system of e-medical, which will take all the point of care things that happen overseas and upstream directly into an electronic database rather than us having all the paper records at the port of entry and doing data entry into EDN and sharing it, trying to move into a 21st century system. We hope that this will start to roll out later in this calendar year and over the next several years, so there'll be essentially electronic record keeping from the origin through this whole chronologic sequence of movement. And so finally, I'd just like to end by acknowledging the huge numbers of people that bring this program and make it happen. It's a privilege to work with these colleagues and many others and many of you, and it truly is the partnership that makes all this kind of effort worthwhile. And I think with this commitment that we have in following KG's inspirational words about finding our common humanity, we can take the scenes above and turn them into the more sort of happy scenes below, and health security and both for the receiving communities and health protection for the affected populations are not an either-or choice. It's a both-and. Everybody wins in this situation. Thanks very much.